3 hours last night. Their options range from taking no formal action to asking the governor to leave office. What they chose was something in the middle, a public reprimand that shows the party doesn't condone Sanford's affair, but doesn't suggest he resign either. Instead, the head of South Carolina's GOP, Karen Floyd, says it's time to move on from the scandal. Sanford followed last night's censure with a statement saying he appreciates his party's position and that he plans on staying in office for the final year and a half of his term. For NPR News, I'm Scott Graff in Charlotte, North Carolina.
An appeals court in Germany has ruled an accused Nazi is fit to stand trial. Heinrich Bohrer is accused of murdering 3 Dutch civilians in an execution during World War II. He is also accused of helping Nazis kill civilians in retaliatory attacks. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, committed to growing economies and expanding human welfare, on the web at kauffman.org.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kelly. This Friday night, Illinois Public Media will co-sponsor a free concert of old-time bluegrass and gospel music by a group called Strings Attached at Kickapoo State Park in Oakwood. The concert is part of the summer music series at Kickapoo, and we'll be pleased to welcome Strings Attached to play live in our studio on the Tuesday edition of Live and Local. Your connection to local music weekdays from noon to 1 on FM 90.9.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of foods from around the world, including cheeses, olives, spices, hot sauces, olive oils, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program, our number 2 of the show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Kyle Mabry's at the controls this morning. In this hour, Focus, we go to the archives for a program we first broadcast in March, all about the U.S. Supreme Court. The guest here is Paul Carrington, professor of law at Duke University. So as you listen to this hour, Focus 580, do keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. The members of the United States Supreme Court are appointed for life as a result of increased life expectancy and perhaps also the expansion in the power and influence of the court. Justices today remain on the court for longer periods of time and to a later age than ever before in American history. This morning, in this hour of focus, we'll look at some proposals that have been made for reform of the court, among them the idea of some kind of term limits for Supreme Court justices. Our guest for the program is Paul Carrington. He is professor of law at Duke University, and he is one of a group of leading law professors that have put together a series of proposals for court reform, which they have sent on to members of Congress, the leaders of the Congressional Judiciary Committees, the Attorney General, Eric Holder, the Vice President, Joe Biden, and among other things, they do indeed suggest a mechanism for limiting the terms of the justices and having a bit more turnover in the court. We'll be talking about how it is these things would work and, of course, take questions and comments from people who are listening. Our guest has taught at Duke since 1978. He served as dean there at the law school from 78 until 1988. He's also taught at universities in Japan and Germany, as well as at a number of other American law schools. He's been active in judicial law reform efforts, particularly with regard to the jurisdiction of appellate courts and the selection and tenure of judges in state courts. Also a contributor to the book and one of the editors of a book titled Reforming the Court, Term Limits for Supreme Court Justices. This is a book that he co-edited. It's actually a collection of papers that grew out of a conference dealing with these issues that took place at Duke in the spring of 2005. So certainly that's something that you can take a look at if you are interested. It's published by the Carolina Academic Press. And questions are welcome, too. We just ask people to be brief when they call in, but questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. And we want to say to you, welcome to the program, Professor Carrington.
Well, thank you very much. It's kind of you giving me an opportunity to visit with folks.
You know, we thought this was a very interesting subject, one which I understand that within legal circles among law professors and such, that this is something that no doubt has been discussed for some time, but it seems to me that until some of the recent stories that we've read about this, it seems that it's not something that's really gotten into the public conversation very much.
No, it certainly hasn't, and it's hard to get it into the public domain very effectively. A bunch of us, as you mentioned, have sent this memorandum around describing four things that might reasonably be done. Our point sort of is to begin with that it'd be a really good idea if the Congress of the United States could sit down and think about the federal courts, and particularly the Supreme Court of the United States and what its responsibilities are. It's a subject that doesn't attract a lot of interest in Congress over the years. There have been very few congressmen who had the will and the energy to try to do anything significant about the federal judiciary. And in some ways, that's kind of a good thing. You don't want them messing around with the federal courts too much. But on the other hand, a little bit of accountability from the judiciary to Congress and the executive is not a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's sort of where we're coming from. But over the long course of history, there's been very few instances when Congress or the president or anybody else took seriously the questions of how we organize the Supreme Court or what should be the law governing the court.
Yeah, in fact, I think that it is the case that really nothing substantial has been discussed in terms of changing the structure of the court really since the controversy touched off by President Roosevelt when he talked about increasing the size of the court.
Well, that's fair. And, of course, that wasn't ever done. It had been done before. There had been some tinkering with size, and one of the scholars of constitutional law of the 19th century published a book about the turn of the century in which he said, you don't need to worry about the Supreme Court. Anytime anybody gets angry about it, we can just appoint some more justices. That proved not to be too good an idea. Actually, my own view of it is, with regard to Roosevelt's problem, was that he had a legitimate complaint about what the Supreme Court was doing, and appointing another justice or two might have been a reasonable thing to do. But then the court backed off of much of what it had been doing and thereby eliminated most of the issue. And I think it was very improvident of the president to go forward with his proposal after that had occurred. But it's widely believed that some of the justices kind of began to change their votes when they thought, well, we're just going to get some more justices appointed.
Mm. Well, I mentioned the fact that you were a contributor to this book, Reforming the Court, that came out of the Duke Conference. Maybe let me just ask you as a direct kind of question. One of the questions here in the first section of the book is posed, is the prolonged tenure of justices a problem requiring attention? Is it?
Well, I think so. The justices don't think so. But, I think it is a significant problem. As people age longer, it's become more of a problem. I think one, just to put it this way, there are two members of the court, Justice Thomas, Justice Alito, appointed at very young ages, with the expectation of the president who appointed them that they would be there a long time. Justice Thomas could easily be on the court for 50 years. Now, that strikes me as inappropriate, to have someone exercising that much power over other people for that long a period of time with no accountability to anybody about what votes he casts or what he does. I think we want an independent court. We want him to be independent. But there is a point at which independence becomes excessive, and that's one aspect of it, is just to cling to the office. And a number of them have done that. And the most recent case was William Rehnquist, who stayed on the court for an extra year when he was mortally ill and in the hospital most of the time and not able to do his job. And somebody should have had responsibility to go to Justice Rehnquist and say, Bill, it's time. But nobody did. Nobody could. They used to have a mechanism for dealing with that. It used to be that it was the job of the junior justice who would be told by the other seven justices, or whatever the number was, go tell Justice Senior Justice that his time is up and he's got to quit.
The person with the lowest guy on on the totem pole was the one who got the job of telling the other guy that he had to
quit. Yeah, that's right. And they used to do that. And they did it all through the 19th century. And Then the last person to do it was Oliver Wendell Holmes, and he went and told Stephen Field that it was time for him to quit, and Stephen Field told Justice Holmes to go to blazes. Hell with that. I'm not going to quit.
Well, this indeed gets at one of the questions that I wanted to ask, and one of the proposals that you make does indeed have to do with this problem that is a justice would be in poor health, would not be able to do the job, and yet would not be willing to step down.
Yeah.
And you've given one example with Mr. Rehnquist. Can you point to many cases like that?
It's a fairly Thurgood Marshall was really quite incompetent the last 18 months or so that he was on the court. He really couldn't do the job at all. At sessions, he couldn't vote. He'd just say, whatever Bill Brennan wants is okay with me. He was a very fine justice and a very fine judge before that and a great lawyer, but he stayed on the Supreme Court. Why did he stay there? Because he didn't want President Bush to appoint his successor, which has gotten into the minds of the justices very much in recent times.
I want to get to your remedy to that particular situation, but just to stay with this point for a moment, it seems this proposal that you're making, you're really saying that rather than, for example, following what they might have done in the past and had the most junior member tell the other person that it's time to go, you seem to be suggesting that really this is the responsibility of the Chief Justice.
Well, yes, it is a responsibility of the Chief Justice, and it should be designated as such, but there ought to be a little accountability for that, too. What we were proposing is that the system that has now just recently been put in place for the lower federal court judges should also be extended to the justices, and that would mean that there is a committee of senior circuit judges who are a group that receives complaints. And if the complaints seem to be valid, I mean, they would go first to the Chief Justice and say, it appears that Justice Douglas is not doing his job and your job to do something about it. But if he didn't, at some point, it would be their responsibility to tell some committee of Congress, the Judiciary Committee, that we've got a justice who's not doing his or her job. And that might or might not lead to some kind of an impeachment proceeding because they're not. You mentioned appointed for life. That's not what the Article 3 says. Article 3 says they're appointed for good behavior.
Mm-hmm.
They can hold office for good behavior. Nobody knows exactly what that means. It's the language came out of the Act of Parliament of 1701, and all it really means is they're supposed to be independent. But I don't think there's anything in the Constitution that would really forbid reasonable long term limits like 20 years or so anything that involved a measure of accountability for disabilities.
Well, that I suppose that leads to the interesting question. As the wording is, as you say, it seems that though that's always been well. Maybe I shouldn't say that's always been. I guess my perception, my understanding is that always has been read to mean that it is a lifetime appointment and that it comes down to the matter that a justice steps down when he or she decides or perhaps when they're so physically infirm that they can't do the job anymore. Has it always been read to mean?
Well, it's not been read. I mean, in fairness, I've heard life tenure mentioned, and people do use those words from time to time. But and I suppose in a practical matter, that's the way it's been. I mentioned the junior justice scheme that worked for about 100 years, and then they stopped doing it because of Stephen Field's reaction to it. So there's been no accountability since about 1920. And they just stay as long as they want, and the reason is nobody knows quite what to do about it. But I don't think the Constitution speaks to the issue at all. And there may be some disagreement about that, and my answer to that is, well, if you think that, then go ahead and amend the Constitution. That ought to be fixed.
But what the other folks that have been involved in this proposal are saying is that your judgment, maybe not everybody would agree, but it's your judgment that, in fact, the Constitution would be okay with this an amendment would not be necessary.
Yeah, that's very much my view, yeah. I don't think we need to amend the Constitution. It depends a little on what you're talking about doing. If you're talking about having short-term limits, then I would say, yeah, that the Constitution doesn't contemplate that, and that would be a violation of Article 3. But I think if you put a 20-year term limit on and said, you know, it's bad behavior to stay after about 20 years, that would be perfectly reasonable, entirely consistent. An age limit also might be fixed if you want to put 75. That's what Parliament did. And there is no country in the world, there are no other judges anywhere on the planet who serve for life. Okay, that's, that term goes with royalty or tyranny. People have some measure of accountability everywhere else for subsiding from the office, and I think you can overdo it. You don't want the judges having to run for office all the time. You do want them to be independent, but at some point, it's important to have people who are reasonably alert, reasonably still in connection with the political process and the society that they are governing. They're exercising a lot of power. This is a political office. They're not just judging cases. They're deciding policy. To leave somebody there to do that for decade after decade after decade, I don't think the Constitution says that. And nobody in the 18th century, of course, was thinking about the kind of life expectancy that we have. And if you were just talking about, you know, one justice who happened to hang in for 30 or 40 years, that might be kind of neat, because then you have a little, you know, institutional memory that goes back a little further, and that's not a bad thing. But as it has evolved, and as we've advanced health care and we take care of these people forever and ever and ever, it's not good.
I have a caller here I want to get to, but just before we do that, just very quickly to make sure that people understand what you're talking about. What it is you're suggesting is something like this, that every 2 years a new justice would be appointed, which would mean in practical terms, I guess, that then we would be moving towards a term of 18 years.
Yeah, something like that.
Something like that. So then the idea is at the end of the 18 years, people would either we sort of be encouraged to retire or perhaps given incentives to retire. And then if a justice wanted to continue to serve, what you would do is you would create a sort of a semi-retired status. They might continue to participate in some cases where it was necessary.
Yeah.
But in a sense, we'd have a continual one or the other, turnover of justices so that – and then that would get around this thing that we talked about earlier where a justice might stay on longer than he or she should because she or he would rather not see the current sitting president make the decision, make the call on who would be their replacement.
That's right. Let me add, this is what we do with lower federal court judges. They do go to senior status, and they take lighter workloads after a sustained period of time, and that's the model for what we're talking about.
All right. We have a caller in the community of Belgium, not all that far away, and we'll go right there, line four. Hello.
Yes, good morning, sirs. There's something that I don't understand, and you may have touched on it. I hope I'm not treading old ground here. In the case of Justice Roberts, ex-President Bush, nominated him, and he became a justice. But then he was nominated to the Chief Justice position. Now, why would the youngest guy on the bench have the most superior position? Why not give it to the person that has a little more seniority?
Well, it's a good question. The Constitution does confer the power of selecting the Chief Justice on the President, and it has to be confirmed by the Senate. So it is a somewhat separate office. One of our proposals is that that office have shorter term limits because it has become a much more political office than it was in the 18th century when they were thinking about it, and there ought to be some measure of accountability. The Chief Justice appoints all the committees of judges that govern the judicial branch. And that wasn't in place long ago, and the Constitution doesn't speak to how long you hold the office of Chief Justice. So I think it would be appropriate to put some kind of term limit on that. We said 7 years, but somewhere along the way, there ought to be an opportunity for the President and the Senate to think about whether this Chief Justice is doing a good job of providing political leadership for a very important political institution.
Thank you very much. very much, sir.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. As we discussed earlier, while the Constitution, what the Constitution says, what this article says, is that the judges shall hold their offices during good behavior. That's essentially what it says about their term, and that we have come to understand that or as meaning lifetime appointment. I think the thing that people understand about this is that the intention of the framers was to try to insulate the court from politics. The kind of thing that you're talking about with having more turnover on the court in shorter terms, do you think that that continues to provide the kind of desired insulation from political pressure that we think we get from the lifetime appointments?
Yes. In short, I don't think. And let me say, the idea of they did want to insulate the court from politics, but they did not envision a court, an institution that is anything like as political as the Supreme Court of the United States has become. Mm-hmm. It is a political institution. What we would like to protect it from is improper influences by other politicians who have different agendas of one kind or another. We don't want them to feel that they have to decide a case in favor of a particular side or a particular issue, just because otherwise they will suffer some shortness of office. They'll get fired. They'll get their salary reduced. None of those kind of things can happen to them. We want them to be invulnerable in that sense. But on the other hand, it doesn't make any sense to conceal the fact that the Supreme Court is exercising a huge amount of power over our lives and over our culture and over our society. And having some system of rotation that does not allow people to sit there for 50 years and try to govern their grandchildren's society is appropriate, and there's not much of an argument, really, about the idea that some kind of limit would be a good thing. The argument among those who thought about it is sort of, well, a constitutional crisis, so I don't know what to do about it, but it's a legitimate problem.
Yeah. Our guest, by the way, let me just introduce for the benefit of somebody who might just tune in. We're talking with Paul Carrington. He's professor of law at Duke University, has been there since 1978. He's taught at a number of other American law schools. He's also taught at law schools in Japan and Germany, has been very involved in judicial law reform efforts, and in fact was one of a group, probably most of them law professors, who put together a series of proposals on reforming the court, the U.S. Supreme Court, and then passed that on to members of Congress, to the Attorney General, to the Vice President. And among other things, they suggest, as we have explained, a system that would essentially provide a term limit to have a new justice appointed every 2 years that effectively would mean that someone would serve on the court for 18 years, and that then at that point there would be various kinds of incentives and encouragement made to retire, and if the person wanted to continue, they would become a senior justice, would be in a sense semi-retired, could still participate when necessary, but in a sense would not be a full justice, as would be this other group of nine who would have this periodic turnover. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we do have another caller here, someone in Arcola, line one. Hello.
Hello. Yeah. I haven't been able to listen to all of the program, but I would like to hear further discussions on why the protagonist believes it would not, in fact, highly politicize the process if it was known that every 2 years another battle would ensue over Supreme Court placement. And, for example, in the last administration, there would have been four battles. And I can't get it in my head that this would all be such a benign process. It would not result in a deeply politicized process.
Well, nobody suggests that it would not be a politicized process, but it already is. And it is true we would have them a little more frequently, and whether that would elevate the intensity, I'm not sure. I don't know one way or the other. I suppose it would depend a little on what kind of political decisions the Supreme Court was making and how agitated people got about one thing or another that they happened to be doing. I don't know. Nobody thinks this is going to insulate the appointment process from politics, but it's already very political.
Obviously, the elephant in the room in this discussion is not the decision the Supreme Court has made. The current Supreme Court is in fact Roe v. Wade, and it's obvious that this would have clearly resulted in the reversal of Roe v. Wade if it had been in place 8 years ago. I think that's the discussion.
Uh-huh. Well, I certainly Roe against Wade was a very pivotal decision, and it did excite a whole lot of attention. It is not our purpose to reverse Roe against Wade, to take a more recent example, the Supreme Court's decision about gun control, which is also a very political decision, and reasonable people could certainly passionately disagree with it. But the thought is, insofar as that's a concern, is that an institution that's going to make judgments like that ought to be at least subject to some renovation over time, and that it shouldn't be as free to make its decisions not only about the cases but about when to subside. One of the possible issues to think about also would be Bush against Gore is another case that very questionable decision. I think that's less. I make very little argument for Bush against Gore. I think this Constitution of the United States could not be more explicit that the Supreme Court of the United States is not supposed to have anything to do with selecting the president, but they did. So they've done some things that stir up a lot of concern, and that's one reason why we are making a number of suggestions that Congress might consider for modifying the law governing the court itself.
Well, I think, though, you're being disingenuous in not recognizing that, in fact, a small minority, I think Frank Schaefer's new book alludes to about 20% of the American population is deeply politicized in the sense that they're part of the right wing. And they are very powerful, but they are only 20% of the population.
Yes. So
establish a system influence the naming of 8 Supreme Court justices. That would be an extremely dangerous establishment, I think.
Well, I don't think it's fundamentally different from what you have. And we do change presidents, and one of the reasons we have a different president, it's not the reason, but it's has some bearing on it, is the reaction to Roe against Wade. But there's a lot of other stuff out there, and I don't really take your point that in order to avoid reconsideration of Roe against Wade, we need to keep our justices serving forever. One of the people who was involved in all this, who would certainly, and I take his advice, he's not around to utter it anymore, but Byron White said a lot of the things we've been saying about the nature of the institution and its need for a little more rotation. And one of the political powers these people are using is the power to choose the president that will choose their successor. Does that bother you any?
I need to jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me because I have some other people and we're already getting past our midpoint. But I guess I'm and I take his point, certainly. But I suppose there also would be people who would make the argument that this kind of turnover every 2 years might actually make the process a little less heated in the sense that, well, the opposing ideological viewpoints would say, well, OK, we got a shot every 2 years now at getting in the kind of person that we think we would.
It does slightly lower the profile of the appointment, so people might be able to live with it a little better. Yeah. Mm.
On to another caller here. I want to thank the last and go to next person in Crete on our line 4. Hello.
Yes, Professor Carrington, I guess it has to be asked. I'm just reading a book on the La Crosse-Duke situation. I wonder if you could have some comments on that since you're a distinguished professor there, and it seemed like some of the school faculty went a little mad. Would you talk about that a little bit?
Well, very briefly, I will say that I thought it was a pretty good book and that there were some pretty nutty people who did some pretty nutty things, and I'm very sorry it all happened.
is that all you're going to say, or one of the most important?
Yeah, I don't. Well, yeah, I mean,
I mean, this is an important issue. There are three books at least out on it. A great deal of discussion is going on in the school. And
well, all I can say, I do not have a lot of factual information myself. That I was not involved in it at any stage.
Well, you lived through it.
Well, I live here in town and read the newspaper, yeah.
Yeah, and you were a faculty member.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah. And I mean,
it must have affected you more than just a cup of coffee and a cup of tea.
Well, to be sure. To be sure. And
give me
I have a grandson who's a lacrosse player at another school, too.
Could you give me your personal opinion of what happened?
Well, I said there were some people who did some pretty nutty things. There was a prosecutor who part of what made this all plausible was that it was hard to believe that our local prosecutor could be as outrageous as he was. And he's now been fired and disbarred, okay?
Well, what about the faculty? What about the president of the university? What do you have to say about that?
Well, he was dealing with a very complicated situation. If you give any weight to the district attorney, then it's a little hard to be president of the university and just run the district attorney away. I'm not sure he did it right. In hindsight, you can say he didn't, but I'm not that critical of the university administration. There was also a nurse, for example. There were a half a dozen people who did nutty things. And I don't know why they did it, but they did create a situation that was not easy to deal with.
All right, I'm going to weigh in here because we're way off topic,
I
hope the caller will indulge me for saying let's get back to what it is we're talking about, assuming that, Professor Carrington, you've said as much as you want to say about it.
I don't have really anything to say about it.
All right, well, we'll go on then to someone back here in Champaign. This is Line 2. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Hi, I just have a question. I know obviously there's the obvious importance on the Supreme Court of maintaining an odd number of justices for voting purposes.
Yeah.
With this two-year turnover, isn't it possible if there's a situation where the right number of justices opt not to retire to the point where maybe there's an even number of justices, some in this semi-retired state?
The provision that we propose as we drafted it is more complicated than that, and we were oversimplifying it. The idea is that the nine most recently appointed justices would sit as the court.
Okay.
That one of the disadvantages the present system has is when somebody is disqualified, you have an even-numbered court.
Right. Okay, well, I like the idea. I think it's good.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Our guest this morning is Paul Carrington. He is professor of law at Duke University. Let me ask you about one of the other proposals here. Particularly in recent years, the last few years, there has been some criticism of the court about their workload.
Absolutely.
And about some people's feeling that they're perhaps not working as hard as they should. And so one of the things that you have proposed is taking away from the court the discretion over which cases they will hear.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's of the four proposals, that's the one I would most prefer personally. A former Solicitor General of the United States said a few years ago, everybody on the Supreme Court deserves a pink slip. Because they have greatly reduced the number of cases they've been deciding. They only got the choice, the choice to decide a case really in the 20th century. The Judiciary Act of 1925 is the main thing here, and it's been extended a little bit further since then. But the idea that the justices look over all the cases being decided by the lower federal courts and hear receive thousands of petitions, and they have a bunch of law clerks, and the law clerks read them all over and suggest to the justices or reasons to take this case or that, and then they pick a few and decide those. Now, how many is enough? When they got this power in 1925, they said, we'll continue to decide 300 cases a year. That was the statement made by the Supreme Court justices when they were empowered in this way. The number gradually dropped down. I was on a committee 40 years ago that thought about this question, and we were concerned that there was too much left to the lower federal courts, resulting in, and they're not organized to be coherent, So there was a lot of uncertainty and confusion about what the law is, because we're not being getting a firm response from the Supreme Court. And so other solutions were being proposed to deal with that. And the justices all then said, well, we'll continue to decide 150 cases a year, and at least, and that was part of the accommodation made to a number of proposals that were made back in the 60s and 70s and early 80s. But now they're down to about 70 cases a year, okay? Mm-hmm. They get 5,000 petitions, and they pick 70 of those cases and say, well, these are important enough to be worthy of our attention. That has something to do with how long they stay. Indeed, Justice Stevens has been quoted a couple of times in recent. I was saying, well, you know, I can stay on here. It's true, I'm in my late 80s, but the job's not all that hard. And they delegate a lot to junior law clerks who help them pick their cases, and they're also delegating a lot to lower federal courts that to just leave unresolved issues that really kind of need the attention of a national court. So, yeah, part of what we were proposing is that there be a panel of senior circuit judges who would be empowered to certify 100 cases a year that would form part of their workload. They could pick some more cases if they felt the need to, and they could certainly continue to retain the power that they have with regard to the selection of cases, but they would be obligated to decide some cases. Mm-hmm. And one of the virtues of that is it returns the court to the role of a law court that decides cases and not just political issues. And that's one of the things I'd like to try to communicate to the justices. John Marshall, when he defended the constitutional powers of the Supreme Court and his right to write opinions of the court about what the Constitution means, affirmed that, you know, I have to do this because I have to decide this case. It's my duty to decide cases, and if I'm going to decide cases, I have to give reasons. And if I'm going to give reasons, I've got to write an explanation for it. We've lost that sense that there's anything that the justices have to do. They don't have any duties. They just pick whatever tasks they would like to perform and do those because they're interesting and they raise questions that justices would like to write about.
All right. Let's talk with someone else in Urbana here, yeah, where we are, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Interesting discussion. Came in a little late, but I was struck by the irony a moment ago when your guest talked about how present Supreme Court justices were affecting the lives of their grandchildren. And then you mentioned that he was on faculty since 1978, which means he now has tenure and can't be fired himself. And maybe I'm comparing apples to oranges, but is there any similarity here?
Oh, a little. And
he wants to get rid of the Supreme Court and limit them, but I'm sure people would like to get rid of a few tenure.
Those of us who are aged tend to be more sensitive to the kinds of arguments that we're making. Absolutely. You know, I'm on half time. If I were czar, I would not vote for the federal legislation that extended tenure past the age of 70, the Age Discrimination Act. I think people ought to be able to hang on longer. But then if you're going to do that, you need a mechanism for saying, sir, your time's up. You're not really getting the job done anymore. Tenure unlimited without any system of accountability, any kind of would be not good. I'm very aware. I'm old enough to fully appreciate the disabilities of age. Okay, I experience a few of them myself, and it's I do think it is at some point totally inappropriate. Now, people do age at different rates, and you need to keep that in mind too. Justice Stevens obviously is very well preserved. But it is also true that he's got an easy job. And, yeah.
Appreciate it. I've just been considering, you know, everybody's aware of it, what old age brings on. Like you say, some are a little more sensitive than others. But, it's an interesting discussion. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you. And other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. You're a part of, I think, part of the argument for having some kind of limits is the idea that perhaps if someone is going to be on the court for 50 years, that somehow they might be out of touch with contemporary politics, contemporary values, and so forth. And the thing about that argument that I think is interesting is that I think it gets you thinking about this question about whether or not the court is actually supposed to be sensitive to changing political values and so forth. And I think perhaps also maybe some people have this idea that the court is not is supposed to be above all of that. And I'm sure, in fact, when you look at the history of the court, you find that the court has never been above above all of that. But this, I think, it again sort of reinforces this argument that, in fact, yes, justices are supposed to be. We want them to be in touch with what people feel, and that, you know, perhaps doing something to try to make that more possible would be a good thing.
Well, I think so. I mean, that's certainly my take on it, that they ought to be. If you want some extreme expressions of that view, there's some uttered in the 18th century by Jefferson. Well, maybe he was in the early 19th. And Thomas Paine wrote an essay about how important it was to not let old folks govern the world. Mm-hmm. Jefferson said the Constitution ought to expire every 20 years. We ought to have to rewrite the Constitution so that it fits the next generation. I think that overdoes it, but I do think there's a point to be made here, and that you don't want people hanging around for too long as the culture and the circumstances change. He was asking me how old I am. I'm old enough that I don't know anything about Facebooks or what kind of culture emerges out of that universe, and don't want to know. You know, it doesn't interest me. What bearing does that have on my qualifications to sit on the highest court and make a lot of big important public decisions?
All right, let's go to another caller, Georgetown. This is line 4. Hello.
Good morning. Very interesting discussion, and something I think definitely needs to occur. It's always been interesting to me that our Constitution has limits for senators and representatives. And, of course, I believe, am I right, that we had to do a constitutional amendment when Roosevelt kept going and we had to stop that so that there was that,
yes.
And the president became limited. So interesting to me that I guess when our founding fathers made the Constitution, they didn't feel at that time that there was a need for limits. Is that because they thought that with shorter lifespans, they wouldn't be serving these many years? Is that why there was never any limits on them, basically?
Well, it was some part of the picture. In fairness, they didn't think about it, okay?
Okay.
The one thing they were clear about is that they did not want the King of England picking their judges and removing them.
Uh-huh.
The colonial judges were subject to removal by the king, and they didn't like that. And so they took the English law, which was the Act of Parliament of 1701, and just copied it into Article 3 of the Constitution.
Okay.
And they weren't thinking about any of the questions we're now talking about, really. They didn't anticipate it would be a very powerful political institution. That was not envisioned in the 18th century. And they didn't think that people were going to live to be 90 years old and in large numbers. I mean, they'd had some old folks around, but it wasn't that they could have a lot of old folks was not within their imagination. So I think it's fair to say they just didn't think about this at all.
Okay, well, I think you have some excellent points. I like the idea of the 2 years. Every 2 years there would be a change. I think that would be very good, because there's no question that we've got some judges on there that have served beyond their time, and some of them that have stayed on, as you have mentioned, that really were not in the best of health and needed to be off. But like you say, how do you get them off? It seems like that seemed to be the problem. And this way, it would be how well do you think it's going to be? Has things like this been proposed before to the legislature, the Congress, and they've
not in the form in which we've put it, which is we drafted some statutes and said here's some things you might think about doing. The issue was we had a conference here about it a few years ago, and there are a lot of people who think that aging is a problem. And the issue, the fourth issue, the one that we discussed earlier about having somebody select the judges' cases.
Right.
Is pretty closely related to a series of proposals that were made in the late 70s and early 80s to try to stabilize the national law a little better and get somebody in charge who's going to tell us what the law is and make sure that it's even-handedly enforced.
Right.
And there were five different reports on that subject over a period of several decades, all of which came to basically the same conclusion, that the present structure of the federal judiciary is not very good. and we ought to do something about it.
I agree wholeheartedly, and I wish you good luck, and I'll contact my congressman and tell him to pay attention to this.
That'd be a kind deed in a cruel world.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. You mentioned that among the many people who might think that this was a good idea, that probably the justices themselves are not among them.
Yeah.
Could such a thing happen? Do you think it's likely that such a reform could happen without the support of at least some members of the court?
I'm not at all optimistic that the four proposals are all going to get rushed through some judiciary committee. I would, to be honest with you, I'd count it a huge success if we could get one of the legislative committees, either the House or the Senate, to actually have a hearing on some of the issues that we are trying to raise. Because we're fully aware that there's a lot of resistance to this on the part of the court. And the basic problem is this, and it explains how we got in these pickles. What is everybody's problem is nobody's special concern. And Congress is very good at attending to people's special concerns, but it's not very good at trying to deal with the larger questions, such as the ones we're trying to raise. There's no political reward for congressmen. If you're trying to get reelected, you can't afford to spend a lot of energy on this because it doesn't have the kind of mileage to it that helps congressmen get reelected. And that's an unfortunate situation, but that's the way it is and the way it's been for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
The federal courts have had two periods when they were really subject to congressional attention. And the first was in the 19th century. There was a guy named William Evarts who was a very powerful politician, and he took over as a senator from New York and got the Judiciary Act of 1891 enacted, which was the first one to create the United States Courts of Appeals. Prior to that time, district judges were accountable to nobody. You put somebody on a district court bench, and they stayed there forever, and they did whatever kind of brutal things they felt like with the power that they were exercising over the people that they confronted. And finally, Mr. Evarts got them to do something about that, and we created the Courts of Appeals. And then in 1920s, William Howard Taft got interested in the courts as Chief Justice and as former president, and he got some new laws enacted, including this one that enables the justices to pick their cases. There have been some good things about the Taft regime, but this is one that I think could stand to be fixed to make some other people pick the cases, at least some of the cases that they would be obligated to decide.
We have other callers. We'll try to get at least one more. And the next in line is in Champaign, and line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I'm not a scholar in this area, so if I have any of my facts wrong, please correct me. But I liked really well something you said a few minutes ago about the court returning to being a law court.
Yeah.
And that contrasts with something that you said earlier in the program, where you mentioned that these people don't just decide cases, they make policy, and that's one of the reasons they should be accountable. And it seems to me that the problem is that the court increasingly in modern times has become a policy-making court, and that's an error. One of the callers mentioned Roe versus Wade, which, if I remember correctly, rests in turn on Griswold from Connecticut.
Yep.
Birth control case.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that in Griswold, the court just made up a policy out of whole cloth and said it's in the Constitution, and that then provided the basis for Roe versus Wade, which has greatly increased the politicization of the entire court system since then. And it seems to me that the correct cure for this politicization of the court system is a systematic return to being the law court and not trying to be a branch of the legislature.
Well, I can't say I disagree firmly with any of your observations about the nature of the process, and that is part of the reason I would prefer to have some of their cases picked by other judges, because I think that would make them take a little more seriously the task of of deciding the dispute that is presented to them, which is what law courts are created to do, and that's what they were organized to do, and that's what the founders thought they were going to be doing. And as they have created a kind of judge-written constitution, and that is, in fact, what we have. It's evolved over a long period of time, but our judges do write constitutional law in the same way that old common law judges wrote the law of contracts, case by case, just by deciding cases. And our constitutional law has taken that form. And there are problems with that, and I that's one reason why you need a little bit of rotation in the court, so that at least it's not totally out of control, and there's some little bit of opportunity to influence the process on the part of those of us who aren't sitting on the highest court.
Well, yeah, the dictum that the law is what the judges say it is. There's a range of interpretations for that. One interpretation is it's part of the human condition that in order for the law to be applied, it has to be interpreted, and we have to have people to do it.
Yeah.
And what they do is going to be what the law effectively is, and it's part of the limitation of the human condition. Another interpretation is we can say what the law is, and so we'll say what we think it ought to be rather than perhaps what the legislature said it was.
Yeah.
And that the extent that we can move toward the first of those systematically and have people understand that this is what we're supposed to be doing, it becomes less important to deal with the effects of the politicization of the sort that you're considering.
Uh-huh.
I should say I'd like very much the proposal of having other judges of the lower courts specify 100 of the things to be. That strikes me as sterling.
Yeah. Well, that's the one I would most strongly favor, but the other proposal strike me as pretty reasonable too. Anyway, it's the idea of the Supreme Court. Just this is a reflection. You might think about the German Basic Law, which they enacted, of course, in the 20th century, on the basis of all of our experience, and they wrote a constitution that's about 120 pages long, and then it creates a highest court that has a lot of judges on it, and they decide what that means. And it's not all that hard to amend their constitution. It can be done. One of the problems we face is it's so darn hard to get all the state legislatures in both houses of Congress super majorities to agree on a text of an amendment. So part of this is structural, and it's there are things that we inherited from our 18th century constitution that if we had to do over again, we wouldn't do.
We are just at the point where we're going to have to finish, and my apology, we have some calls we can't take. Just one final quick question. If, however unlikely, supposing that your proposals were accepted and passed by Congress, particularly the first about changing the structure of the court, could then the Supreme Court declare it unconstitutional?
Well, I suppose they could. They had the starch to do that, yeah. Then it would make it a lot easier to amend the Constitution. If you had the Supreme Court declaring that nobody can do anything about it, then I think we could amend the Constitution. That would create a political situation in which there would be enough energy to do that.
Well, there we're going to have to stop with our thanks to our guest, Paul Carrington. He's professor of law at Duke. Professor Carrington, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives, originally broadcast in March of this year. If you'd like to go back and hear some of our past programs, interviews from Focus, from the Afternoon Magazine, all of our local production is available through our website. That's will.illinois.edu. Support for the broadcast today comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy at Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana. A zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future environment. It's part of what makes a Subaru. A Subaru, information online at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910. WILL thanks Jack and Marjorie Richmond for their gift of the Richmond Journalism Teaching Studio, adjacent to Campbell Hall for public telecommunication. That's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned for the Afternoon Magazine. More coming up as part of the show, and sitting in today as host, Tom Rogers.
Good morning, Dave, and good morning, everybody else. And we have an archived interview coming up in the 1 o'clock hour after our noon hour look at news. We'll hear from the archives an interview that Celeste did with David Friedman, the author of a book called A Perfect Mess, The Hidden Benefits of Disorder. He'll give us a little reason why it might not be so bad to be messy. Coming up right now, though, is the commodity market update, and the bean prices have fallen quite substantially today on lower crude oil prices mainly. The wheat and corn holding their own a little bit, but down a little bit. The July Kansas City wheat contract now down 4.25 points, or cents rather, at 5.38 a bushel. September down a penny and a half at 5.49 and a half. In Chicago on the Board of Trade, July wheat is up a penny and a half at 4.92. September up 1 and a half at 5.20 and three quarters. Corn is also showing a bit of a difference in a mixed picture right now. Nearby July corn is up 5.25 cents at 3.48 and a half, but the deferreds are off. September is down a penny and a quarter at 3.33 and a half. December at 3.41 and a half, down 2 and three quarters. And the March 2010 corn contract is down 3 at 3.53 and a quarter. Soybeans right now, the nearby July contract down 70 cents at 11.30. August at 10.51 and a half, down 67.